Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, you're listening to FUBAR Radio, and this is me, Nick Helm. I'm joined, as ever, by my trusty co-host, Nathaniel Metcalf.
Hello.
Say hello, Nat.
Hello, Nat.
Fucked it! You talked over me! This was the one time that we were going to be really fucking slick. Yeah. You said, wouldn't it be great if we were slick? And then the very first thing you do, I upheld my end of the deal, Nathaniel. Yeah. The very thing you do is you talk over me.
You went slightly off script and it threw me. I'm not very good at improv.
We'll try to be better at improving your radio. Hello, my name's... This is Fan Club. Oh, it's a pit of fuck. So it's Friday. It's noon, midday. Good morning.
Yes. Good morning.
Bringing it back.
It's a bit matches with all the guys' t-shirts, all the merch we do. So yes. We got some of that back.
Yes. I saw some merch the other day.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Not for Fan Club.
For yourself? Some Nick Helm merch?
No.
Oh. Do you have an online store? This isn't an advert, I'm just interested.
Do I have an online store? I do have an online store, yeah.
So you can buy some various tour merchandise.
You can buy music. It's got links to Amazon. I don't know why I do links to Amazon, though, because I don't make any money off of that. I got paid when we made the stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't get paid for, like, DVD sales or anything like that.
It would be also not worth your while to have it going to you and you then have to pop down the post office every day. And that's a pain in the arse as well, isn't it?
It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. It works like it's just a link to Amazon and then people can buy it off Amazon. But it's just so that people don't ask me all the time about it. But what Stuart Lee does... I don't know if I'm allowed to say.
Well, he sells his stuff after the show, doesn't he?
But he buys everything off.
Oh, yeah. But also lots of authors do that as well. They buy books from their publisher to sell at signings and things and events. Right. So I guess that's sort of how they do it. So it's sort of a kind of... But it's smart, really, isn't it? Smart.
Well, people buy your DVD for full price, yeah? Mm-hmm. Then sell it or give it away because it's a coaster now. And then you buy it back and then you resell it.
Yeah.
So I make a big thing. Every time I sell anyone anything, I take it straight out of the cellophane because it's just fresh fruit. So if you buy from me, guys, you're buying one previously unowned item of merch. It's not a sales pitch, but...
It's in mint condition, you're saying. It's one, no owners, mint condition.
My bum is in mint condition. It's got a hole in it. That was lovely.
That was improv. I could see your little brain whirring. You see your eyes moving there.
It's an old joke. It was a joke. Do you ever remember? I don't know if you do. Anyway, first rule of Fan Club, tell your friends about Fan Club. Second rule of Fan Club, please, for the love of God, tell your friends about Fan Club. Oh, my God, this is not good lighting for me. My skin is absolutely terrible.
Well, I think it's very good lighting for me.
Yeah, you look brilliant.
I'm admiring myself. I've got a window in front of me. It's daylight, so I've got some natural light.
Can I get a word in? I was just about to say...
I was trying to talk about how good-looking you was.
I was just about to say how angelic you look, Nathaniel.
Thank you.
And you ruined it by
if you were going to say that, I wouldn't have spoken over you.
Garbling over me! Once again, I talked so much last week. You didn't get to recommend anything. So I thought it went really well. So there's going to be lots more where that came from, guys, if you've tuned in based on last week. If you've tuned in based on the week before, where, you know, it's probably about a 65-35 split in my favour, then no, those days are over. It's going to be a 90%, 10% split in my favour from now on.
I watched one of those things years ago, which is like a Channel 4 documentary.
Can I get a word in? Every word counts, Nathaniel. May I remind you?
Go for it. I've got to make a note of my thing.
Go on, what were you saying?
Uh, I know, just so, sorry,
that'd be good. Years ago,
after Rod Hull died, where Channel 4 at the time doing a thing that was like the real Rod Hull, and it was meant to be like one of those kind of behind the scenes, what he was really. And one of them was, one of the things he said was, when the Pink Windmill show was cancelled from Children's ITV, when he kind of came back to the meeting, I think they were filming the last series at the time, and he was just told it wasn't going to get renewed at the end of that series. I think he goes back into the rehearsals or where they were filming it or something, and the woman who plays Grotbags says to him, "Well, what's the news, Rod?" He said, and apparently he just turned to her and said, "Gravy train's over." They're all earning money off Rod.
Like, as opposed to the fact that she had a legitimate part in the franchise,
yeah,
and she was an actress and she played her part and she got paid for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically saying that everyone else that was involved in the Pink Windmill was using him.
Yes. But also what was funny was the flip side of that was the following year, Grotbags got her own series.
Yeah, I was going to say, she got a spin-off, right?
Yeah, she got a spin-off.
Yeah, it's Carol Lee Scott.
Carol Lee Scott. Carol Lee Scott played Grotbags.
Carol Lee Scott. It's weird that we both knew that at the same time, isn't it?
It's weird, yeah. Yeah.
Carol Lee Scott played Grotbags. Interesting. Or is it? One of my worst ever gigs. I'm just going to shut my window. Phil.
Well, Carol Lee Scott is also, is a great clip of Carol Lee Scott being interviewed by...
Sorry about that, guys. I'm back. So, what were you saying? What were you saying?
I was saying that... It's actually really funny. It's really funny what you did. Carol Lee Scott was interviewed. There's a clip of her on YouTube where she guests on an episode of Bullseye, like a celebrity Bullseye, and it's one of those clips I always watch.
As Grotbags?
No, as herself, as Carol Lee Scott. So I think she's like a comic. I think she's like a sort of working men's club comic or something at the time.
That makes absolute sense. Tell you what I was thinking about. I'm not cutting you off. You mean we're having a conversation?
Yeah,
that's just difficult over Zoom, isn't it?
It is.
Probably best I take over now. I was remembering Big Cook, Little Cook.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my very first gigs was I used to work data entry in Hatfield. I probably talked about that. So mm-hmm. when I wrote I Think You Stink. So I always remember because it was 2008. So I used to work between 2006 and 2008. I used to work in pubs. I did my first ever gig September 2000, just for my 26th birthday in September 2006. Worked in pubs, and then I started having to work evenings, so I had to give up working in a pub. And then I started doing like data entry and stuff like that. So I had this job in Hatfield where Monday to Wednesday I'd have to... addresses. It was like a startup. It was like a business startup place. I think it's called Business. Probably really famous. I don't want to get in trouble. Business. I used to work at Business Link in Hatfield, just opposite the Galleria in this kind of business park. And I used to have material about it. I found my first ever gig the other day on a DVD. You know, do you remember Mostly Comedy in Hitchin?
Yeah.
So they used to give you a DVD of your gig. Do you remember?
I don't know if I didn't have a DVD. I don't remember getting a DVD from them, but maybe I was given one at some point.
Yeah, they used to send you, you'd do it, and then they'd tape it all, and they'd send you a DVD of a gig, and I found it. It was like my first ever 20. Because I'd only had like 15 or something like that. And then they said, we're going to pay you to do 20 minutes and headline. And I was like, what the fuck am I going to do for 20 minutes? So I put a song in. And then the song went better than anything else. And then I became a musical comedian. And I was just like, oh, songs. You write a song. If you can make a song last 5 minutes, you only need two of them. And then you just talk for 10 minutes. You introduce it for 2.5 minutes and apologize for another 2.5 minutes. And then, you know, and then you got 20 minutes, right? So I just started a song and I did that. And so my material was, when I was working at Business Link, was I work in an open plan office. So I've worked out that if I can make my my internet screen, my internet browser, the exact same size as my head, I can go on Facebook all day and no one will notice. I just have to stay really still. Right, that was the material. And I was like, I was surprised by like how much of my material was about working in an open plan office, right? And it's true though, if you make it the exact size of your head, or maybe about the size of your face, and you just sit in front of it. But like the job was you would take all of this stack of paper with people who filled in by hand their names and addresses. I mean, this is a job that doesn't exist anymore, right?
No, probably not.
People had filled in their names, addresses by hand, their phone numbers, and I would have to take each handwritten piece and type in the code that they'd written in, their phone number, their address, their name, their postcode. I'd have to put everything in. And it all had to like line up. And if it didn't line up, then it didn't work. So it was this really, like, and you'd do that. It would take like 10 minutes to do each form. You'd double check it. You'd click all these boxes. I don't know if it took 10 minutes. Maybe it took 5 minutes. And then you'd move on to the next one. And it would be the exact same thing all day, every day. And if you got it wrong, you'd have to redo it, right? So you couldn't do it on autopilot. You'd have to actually concentrate to do it. You couldn't be hungover. You'd just have to do it, right? And then on Wednesday, you'd swap over and you'd have to stuff envelopes, right? And you'd have to print out the address and stick the address on all the envelopes, double check everything. And you'd do that Wednesday to Friday. And so you'd get absolutely fucking sick of stuffing envelopes. And then Monday, you'd have to go back to doing the data entry. And you'd be like, thank God. So the first half of Monday was brilliant, right? And then you'd be really fucking bored of it by Wednesday lunchtime. Good news, you're stuffing envelopes. It was like...
Best job.
It was great. One day, I got a phone call from a friend. It was an email off of a comedian friend. And she said, I've got this slot for Nuts TV, but I can't do it. It's £100. I had a joke about this as well. I was working 9 to 5:30. So I used to say, I work 9 to 5:30, which is officially half an hour longer than Dolly Parton ever fucking bothered with, right? And then I think I said it on TV and somebody wrote, Dolly Parton has more talent in her little finger than you'll ever have. And it's just like, it's not a joke. It's not a joke about, I'm wearing a fucking Dolly Parton T-shirt right now. Anyone that knows me knows how much I fucking love Dolly Parton. Yeah. The joke isn't about how shit Dolly Parton is. The joke is about 9 to 5:30.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a better joke.
Natalie, can we get Dolly Parton on?
Let's get her on to see if she's offended. Natalie, can we get her on?
Next week, apparently.
Anyway, I won't keep talking, but what I'll say is, I'm going to keep talking. So I used to work 9 to 5:30. I think I worked like four, we'd have like an hour off for lunch, which is standard. I can't remember what it was, but it basically boiled down to the fact that I worked about 40, 41 hours a week and I made £205 a week, right? Which is like almost the worst job I've ever had.
So I guess it's like, so does that work out at like £12,000 a year after tax or something, is it?
I think it's less than that, isn't it? It's less than that. No, because if it's £200 a week, then you make you make £820 a month. I mean, you can't...
No.
I lived in St Albans and it was kind of like, you drink that on Friday. Do you know what I mean? It was like, there was no... I couldn't move out of my... Anyway, so I couldn't move out of my parents' house when I was there. So what happened was I got this email saying, do you want to do Nuts TV? You've got to do 5 minutes for Nuts TV. I don't even know if Nuts TV doesn't exist anymore, right? Oh. Nuts Magazine doesn't exist anymore. Do you want to do 5 minutes? So I was like, yeah. And it was £100 for 5 minutes. You just had to get yourself to London. I was like, fucking hell, you get £100 for 5 minutes. You know, that takes me all the way up to stuff in envelopes. That does. That's Monday to envelopes. I could get £100 for just doing that, right? So I told my supervisor that my boiler had broke. It was that afternoon, and I told my supervisor, oh, my boiler's broke, I've got to go home and sort it out. And he was just like, yeah, of course. Like, didn't give a shit, because my job was so, like, unimportant. Like, if you don't do it, someone else will just do it. It was like, oh, right. I remember, like, a lot of people... Like the highlight of my Nuts TV closed on 15th of January 2009, which was a year after I did it. So that's fine. No, it's like 6 months after I did it. Fucking hell. I closed BBC Three and Nuts TV. That's incredible. Oh, fuck. So she keeps giving us facts about Nuts TV. It's putting me off. This story is going to go on forever. I've been talking for 20 minutes. Oh, Nat's going to have to do the entire second half hour. Oh, Lord have mercy. So anyway, I go to London. So I go into London to do 5 minutes of TV on Nuts TV. I think Catherine Ryan was there very, very long time ago. And I think she was doing it as well. And we've all went on and did 5 minutes. It was hosted by the guy from Big Cook, Little Cook.
Yeah, I know you mean. Dan Wright.
Yeah, right. He had red hair, skinny guy with red hair, and I was I saw it, and I was just like, it was weird because it was my first ever TV, but it didn't really feel like TV. It was kind of like it was sort of like set in a comedy club that was in the basement of Nuts TV, where anyone that didn't have to airbrush some tits was sort of like, can you go downstairs and pretend to laugh at some comedians? You'd like perform in front of some people that were really not that. I think they had like prop beers and stuff, and they weren't. It was in the middle of the day; they weren't really that interested. So you did it. You did your 5 minutes, but it was like, and I remember like feeling like a cross between. I'm making £100 for 5 minutes. That means literally £200 for 10 minutes. That means I'm making £1,200 an hour. Yeah. I thought, I have hit the big time. Not only that, but there's a guy off the TV that's hosting it. And I remember thinking, that's a bit weird that the guy off of Big Cook, Little Cook is like a stand-up comedian. But now it's obviously, that's the way it goes, isn't it? So long story short, it doesn't surprise me that Grotbags was a stand-up.
Fantastic.
I was going to say, one of my worst ever gigs was for Tom Rosenthal. Where does Tom Rosenthal live? I feel like he lives... Where does Joel Dommett come from?
Bristol.
Bath. Does he live in Bath?
Maybe.
I remember I got a bus down to Joel Dommett's gig. So I've done that gig. Was that... A cricket pavilion, maybe. Anyway, I did a Tom Rosenthal gig. I think it was me, Sarah Pascoe, Tom Rosenthal, Jim Rosenthal was there, Tom's dad. Tom's a lovely boy, and it was in this. Tom was born in Hammersmith. Yeah, but like, I think it was Rockham. Is the name of the place where they live now? Oh, I probably shouldn't. Anyway. No, they walk around outside, don't they? People know. The local guy there is Timmy Mallett. So Timmy Mallett lives there. When I was growing up, I had Timmy Mallett's books, used to watch Timmy Mallett every week. Loved Timmy Mallett.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Who doesn't?
Exactly.
Who didn't? I get to this gig for Tom Rosenthal, and I like the thing I like most is when I, as a performer, is when you get everyone. You know, when everyone's on board. You know, it doesn't matter about how old they are. And one of my biggest satisfactions is to get like a room full of like people with white hair or grey hair, and have them laugh at the same stuff as people my age or younger. You know, mm-hmm. I really love it. It also, it's good so you can point at them and say, "See, Mum, they find it funny." Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, I haven't wasted my life. not everyone thinks I'm an offensive cunt. Not my words, her words, ladies and gentlemen. So when I got there, there were kind of like, there were some very old women that were putting out candles on all the tables. And I had like a bad inkling. I thought, oh God, no, this might not go very well. Mm. And I went on. Everyone did a really good job. Everyone had a really great gig. And it was sort of, the audience was sort of in the round. And Jim Rosenthal was sort of like at the front to the side. And I don't know where Timmy Mallett was. But
he was at the gig?
He came to the gig, yeah. So it was like star-studded. Jim Rosenthal, Timmy Mallett.
Like Live at the Apollo.
Well, fucking hell, it had Tom Rosenthal, me, Sarah Pascoe on. I can't remember who else was on, but it was like...
But at the time, you wouldn't have been a big deal, right?
No, we were pieces of shit. But, although Sarah Pascoe had done some telly, I think. But, okay. But she may have headlined, I don't know. And that's not like, but like everyone at that gig went on to do stuff, you know. So we were at the gig. Anyway, so everyone does really good. Except for me, who's fucking, nobody likes me. And I'm not going to say I did badly, like I was bad, because I did the same as I would have done had I done well. You know, I'd just told the audience off. I'd have complained that no one was laughing enough, all of that. If it goes well, I'd do it. And if it went badly, I'd do it. But they really hated me. So I did what I always do when people hate me, which I did twice as long as they asked me to. So I did like half an hour instead of 15 minutes. They really fucking hated me. They were taking photos that evening, and there was a really good photo of me on stage. Because it was in the round, you just have Jim Rosenthal in the background with his hands on his face and his mouth sort of like agape, just like going... Like, but not like, oh my God, what's he saying? Like, more like, oh my God, he's still on. and I came off stage and we went out the back of the fire exit to like cool down or have a fag or whatever. It was me and Tom were standing at the back, and Timmy Mallett walked past, my hero, and he just goes, "Oh, Tom, well done. You did a great night tonight. It was you really organised a great night. Well done. You were really funny, and you know, you should do more of these." And then he just looked right through me. Couldn't think of anything to say. And then turned back to Tom and he went, "Good night." And I was like, "Oh, mate, I bought your fucking book." But yeah, so Grot Bags, great stuff. We've got 2 minutes. Have you got anything to say now? Oh my God, how's lockdown?
I'm trying to think if I feel like there are probably instances where there's been kind of some well-known people in the audience. I think I did a gig, one of Josie's gigs once, and Daniel Kaluuya was there pre Get Out. So I don't know if it counts as much as
pre Get Out, but was it post Johnny English Reborn?
It might have been. I could neither confirm nor deny.
Sure.
I wouldn't have been sure at the time either, I don't think.
Sure. Because that was on telly on Saturday.
Oh, did you see that, right?
It was on telly last week. He was in it. Not only, I think he's sort of like a Ben Miller replacement.
Oh, right, okay. So he's like the sidekick.
But, like, I feel like Johnny English Reborn was made, like, last year.
Yeah, do you know what? I think it was. There was one out not too long ago, like...
No, I think it was probably, fucking 10 years ago.
Jesus. That's 2011. Terrifying when you read those things.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrifying.
Absolutely. That's a whole, like, fucking hell. That's a whole career ago.
Yeah. I mean, We spent 1 year of that indoors. That's what's sort of sad at the moment. I'm going, oh, God, I mean, barely been out for a year.
Daniel played Agent Colin Tucker. There you go. For all of you
Johnny English fans.
All you Johnny English fans. I'm going to have to stop you there, Nathaniel. We've got to play a song. We'll come back to that after the storm. All right, okay.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. We are back. We're back in. We're back. I couldn't think of a thing. So what are you saying about Daniel Kaluuya?
I was saying I did a gig once and he was in the audience. That was basically it. As an addendum.
That's not his name, is it?
Daniel Kaluuya, isn't it?
Yeah, right, okay.
Isn't it? I'm pretty sure. He was there. But then afterwards, because I'd seen him at a gig and I'd sort of spoken to him, like, really briefly, and it was very nice, since then I feel like he's, like, whenever I see him in a film or something, it's almost like he's my mate. But I've had no interaction. I've barely had an interaction with him. I always go, oh, well done. He's done well, hasn't he? I feel like I, when he was, like, up for an Oscar and things, I remember being a bit like, yeah, well, you know, I probably had a bit of something to do with that, imagine. That's probably... I sort of took some pride in it for no reason whatsoever.
Mm, sure. I thought you were going to say that every time you see him now, he barely acknowledges you. So he's changed. But
barely acknowledged me then, I think.
Daniel apparently wrote his first play when he was 9.
That's good to know.
Yeah, but like, I mean, I'm pretty sure I wrote my first play when I was 9. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I think we probably all have written a play when we're 9.
It's only like relevant now that he's famous, right?
Hmm.
But we've all achieved stuff when we were 9. I'm not being bitter about this. I'm just like saying, we've all achieved stuff when we're little. Like, do you know what I mean?
Where was this play staged? Was it put on anywhere?
I put on a fucking play in my fucking living room. Do you know what I mean? When I was 5, I'd have costumes and stuff like that. Me and my sister would put costumes together. We'd rehearse all afternoon. We'd get our mum and dad to come into the living room. They'd watch. They'd applaud. Standing O's all round, man. For me, my sister dropped a few lines and it was evident. So she didn't get as much glory. Heard about that in the green room afterwards, but it was fine. So yeah, I know. Okay, cool. Well, I just think as a fun fact, Daniel wrote his first play when he was 9. I think you could say a lot of people had done stuff when they were 9.
But apparently, it was about 2 men who worked in a McDonald's, and he was a competition winner. But it was performed at London's Hampstead Theatre, so I guess it was quite impressive.
Oh, London's Hampstead Theatre. Yeah. Well, once I entered. A fancy dress contest at the Barbican.
Yeah.
I must have been about 4. And had a bit of help from my dad. But let's just say we've all had achievements. No, well done. Well done, Daniel, if you're listening. We should get him on as well. We might have to bump Dolly Parton for him if we can get him on next week. But I think it'll be worth it. Ask him all about Johnny English.
He was in, I think, wasn't he? So, but don't ask about Johnny English, unless you're saying, was watching Johnny English one of the things that made you want to be in the sequel, Johnny English Reborn?
Oh, sure. Was watching all them Barclay card adverts, you know, did you think one day you'd be in the sequel to the spin-off movie?
Yeah, yeah. What was Richard in the Barclaycard adverts? His sidekick was played by was he called Henry Naylor? Was he called the comedian Henry Naylor?
Henry Naylor, right? Okay, because when I was watching Johnny English 2 weeks ago,
yeah,
which was filmed at St Albans Abbey, that stars John Malkovich and Rowan Atkinson. When I was watching that, I was thinking, who was... Because I thought Ben Miller might have done it in the Barclaycard adverts.
No, I think it's Henry Naylor. It's Andy Parsons' comedy partner, isn't it? Who was in the ads.
So what's his name? Henry Naylor.
Yeah. Yeah. And when they did the film with Ben Miller, wasn't it? And but like it always feels like Ben Miller isn't like significantly more famous, is he?
No, but he might have been significantly more available.
Oh, maybe that's it. Maybe that's it.
No, I think Ben Miller was quite big at the beginning of the Armstrong and Miller show.
That yeah, no, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose that would probably, yeah, that was on BBC One at one point, wasn't it?
No, but then that was like, they had a Channel 4 mid-90s Armstrong and Miller show. You know the Austin Powers joke where they're naked and they keep, like, putting stuff in front of their genitals? That was on the Armstrong and Miller before it was on Austin Powers. I don't know if it's like an old standard classic joke that's been going for it, but in terms of like a TV sketch show, they did that like 1 or 2 years before Austin Powers did it. I think the punchline to theirs was that they just showed their dicks.
Yeah.
But when it came up in Austin Powers, it's just kind of like, oh yeah, like Armstrong and Miller. And then Ben Miller was in the Steve Coogan Ealing comedy esque The Parole Officer. He was in that. So I imagine he was quite a hot ticket by the time Johnny English came along.
Yeah. Do you know what I'd like we should do? We should do the director's commentary for Johnny English. And we just basically talk in what we think other people have been on. And
why Henry Naylor wasn't available.
Yeah, but just guessing. We don't know. It's just based on what we know already.
Well, I think that if you line up the beginning fan club fanfare, which is me saying, welcome to fan club, mm-hmm. you line that up with the beginning of Johnny English and you press play on whatever your device is, then you can listen to this. It's about 2 hours long, Johnny English with adverts. You can listen to this and watch Johnny English with the sound off.
Mm. There has to be a Johnny English that's been on ITV and has all the adverts in as well.
Doesn't affect the quality of the show much, of the film, because it's largely sight gags.
Sure.
But the thing is, it's a bit lowbrow. So I think that what happens is when you're watching the sight gags, very funny. But then, you know, if you listen to this instead of the soundtrack to the film, it makes you think as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Ben Miller, who featured as the sidekick Boff in Johnny English, said he had not been approached to reprise his role in Reborn.
Why is that then?
Don't know. I mean, probably. I mean, Ben Miller can say that, but like, how do you think Henry Naylor feels? He would also be probably a similar thing. Shoes on the other foot now, Ben.
Well, wasn't Ben Miller maybe filming Death in Paradise at that point?
Could have been.
Probably. I would say he's probably busy filming Death in Paradise.
Yeah, I'd like to think.
So he wasn't approached, but they just looked at his... They just, geographically, they were just like, oh, it's going to be a bit of a commute coming in all the way over there.
Yeah. Also, so, you sort of wonder, like, I suppose, would you... The agent might even get just have a thing and go, can't do it. Can't do it.
I always think that. Yeah. I'd love to see a Bond film where they say, oh, you need to go over to Hawaii, Bond. And he goes, I'm busy. I go, not a problem. He goes, oh, my boiler's broke. I go, not a problem, Bond. And they get, you know, 0012 to do it instead. And then, like, 3 months later, someone spots Bond doing a Type 5 on Nuts TV. It's just like, what?
Imagine that if your agent said to you, yeah, we want to check out Nick's availability for this Bond film, this filming next week. and your agent goes, when's it till? September. No, because on August the 5th, he's doing a gig in Chessen. So it's not going to work out.
I'm not entirely sure. Things like that haven't happened, my friend. Oh, he can't do that. He's doing fan club.
And that's every week. So there's no way to get out.
That's every week. There's no... Imagine. Oh, my God.
Well, it could probably... Like, how long is it for? A couple of them. I don't know if you get a chance to record more than two in the bag in a week, really. So maybe if it's just for 1 week, we could... But I'm afraid it's a no. It's going to be a no.
It's going to be a no. If you could have him available... Well, if you could have him available for about 1:45 on Wednesday, and then back on again at 4:15, maybe. But and he's got to be camera ready, is the thing.
It's a webcam, so he has to be like.
It's a webcam. He can't be in. He's got to be as appearing as himself. The writers had decided not to bring back Boff, and decided to. Oh, it's your issue. The writers have decided not to bring... No, I can't do it. The writers have decided not to bring back Boff.
Ben Miller.
And decide to replace him with new character Agent Tucker.
Daniel Kaluuya.
Miller did film a cameo to link the two movies together, but was cut.
That just suggests... That's fine then, isn't it? So it's like he was brought back to say... to sort of make it all make sense and things.
Well, apparently John Cusack came back to do a cameo for Hot Tub Time Machine 2.
Hmm.
They cut that as well.
That seems silly.
What, Hot Tub Time Machine?
But why would you cut it out? Because it's a nice little echo, isn't it?
I think if you're John Cusack, it's a blessing in disguise, really, isn't it? I'm not sure how much he didn't come back for the sequel, did he?
No, and at the minute, it's sort of weird. John Cusack's career now, almost, you know, anything goes, isn't it?
I completely forgot that he'd done Hot Tub Time Machine. It was a big hit. I think everyone signed on to it based on the title. But I didn't enjoy that film.
No. There was that film a couple of years ago, wasn't there? Actually, I say a couple of years ago. It's probably 10 years ago. The one where it's John Cusack and Paul Dano playing Brian Wilson.
That's great. It was ages ago.
How was it?
Or maybe it wasn't. Maybe it feels longer ago than Hot Tub Time Machine. Maybe it was 2006.
It's like it was produced by John Cusack, wasn't it?
I didn't mean 2006. I meant 2016, but it was 2014.
2014, Love and Mercy.
Doesn't feel like that long ago. That was great, I thought.
Paul Dano is sort of like perfectly cast as Brian Wilson. But John Cusack obviously wants to play Brian Wilson. So plays a slightly older version of Brian Wilson. But then Cusack and Dano look so little like each other that it's really jarring when it cuts between the different eras. You go, I just can't make them two people out to be the same person.
It's like John and Julian Lennon. they both look like John. No, it's Julian Lennon and Sean Lennon.
Sean Lennon,
they both look like John, but they don't look like each other. It's not really like that because neither of them are related to Brian Wilson, and they don't really look like Brian. The thing is, like, they're both really good actors, and if John Cusack is definitely going to be in it, they could have just made a bit more of an effort to find someone that looks like a young John Cusack.
Yeah, that's what I kind of think. That's where they've kind of it's almost like Dano's turned up and he's like, he does look like Brian Wilson, perfect, good actor. But then it's like when it cut between them, you're going, very difficult to make them have to be the same guy.
Yeah, I agree.
Decent film. Decent film.
I thought it was a great film. I thought it was a great film. And to be honest, I just love seeing John Cusack in something good, you know?
Again, I think that was another one that he produced, wasn't it? So he sort of had that run of High Fidelity, Gross Point Blank. And these were like that. Those films were kind of like the making of him, weren't they? They were almost like him... re-emerging on the scene as this sort of guy who's like a producer and making films that really work for him and make like kind of... It felt like those films really do feel like he's producing them and co-writing them and he's like... And they feel like real, like, John Cusack projects. Like, oh, this is good. You're really like taking charge of your own career and making films that really suit you.
Oh, he produced Hot Tub Time Machine as well.
Okay.
That was the thing. But weirdly, I mean, I grew up watching The Sure Thing. So my sister was a big Sure Thing fan. And so we watched that a lot growing up. He was something crazy, like 19 when he made The Sure Thing. And obviously he was in Stand By Me as well, in the flashbacks. So I always felt like John Cusack was like this big megastar in our household. We all loved John Cusack. And then when Gross Point Blank came out, it was kind of, it didn't ever feel like he'd been away, but obviously he was taking more control over his career. He never talks about Con Air. He's got nothing particularly nice to say about it. They say, tell us about your character in Con Air. And he says, well, he wears sandals. that's what he says. Obviously he did High Fidelity. But then I can't forgive him for stuff like Serendipity.
It's Kate Beckinsale.
I just thought that was atrocious. So it's kind of like you don't talk about Con Air, which you're a small cog in a large machine, but it's a machine that works very well. It's a really entertaining film, and you have a part in that. So maybe it's just about, I don't know. But I just thought Serenity was kind of like, this feels like... And it's not because it's romantic comedy. It's Serendipity. It's not because it's a romantic comedy. It's just, oh, I don't know. I really hated it. And then Must Like Dogs. But I mean, he was originally the actor chosen to play John Bender. I mean, what... John Bender in The Breakfast Club. He was originally there. Yeah, he would have been really good. I really do love John Cusack. Have you ever seen the film War Inc?
Well, I think I think people in general really like John Cusack. I think I think we're very fond of him and wish him well in the movies. But he's another one, isn't he? Who feels like he's a bit kind of director TV movie now actor. And I don't really know at what point that happened. Whereas a better path for him probably would have just been kind of pursuing more kind of indie film, wasn't he? It's that thing I keep saying about Ethan Hawke has done this. He's sort of both sort of flips between doing kind of small movies and big movies, but his whole attitude to it is wanting to live like kind of like a sort of middle class lifestyle. So he's never chasing big money. He's just always doing the thing that's like, yeah, I'll do that. And I'll occasionally do a big movie if one comes along, but I'm not like, he's almost like he doesn't want to get on the path of wanting to be a big megastar. I'll just take them as they come.
Yeah, but I feel like they've got very different careers.
Mm.
I feel like Ethan Hawke might not chase blockbusters, but he doesn't necessarily just work for the sake of working.
Mm.
Whereas John Cusack, there's like a huge dip in quality of what he does. I mean, I don't know. Did you ever see War Inc?
No.
Which was sort of like a spiritual sequel to... Gross Point Blank.
No, not at all.
He plays like a hitman who only wears black. I think Joan Cusack plays his agent, and he's hired to start a war. And it's kind of like all of the same elements as Gross Point Blank, except maybe without the romantic comedy aspect. But he didn't write it. I think it might even be based on a book, but it's sort of like this weird sort of like film where they tried to sort of like replicate Gross Point Blank, but I've never seen it. Dan Aykroyd was also in it.
Okay.
He wrote and produced War Inc. Oh, he did. There you go. I mean, this is just us like muddling our way through John Cusack now. did you ever see Identity?
No.
Well, that's a shame. It was, who was it? It was James Mangold. So the guy that did Copland and what's the fucking Wolverine film called?
He did Logan.
Logan.
And he always has... He did Walk the Line, and the Logan film has had a Johnny Cash song in it. He did Walk the Line as if, like, it's almost like, you've done it now, John. James. You've done your Johnny Cash, but he obviously loves him and keeps putting it in his films, much like Zack Snyder and Alleluia. Can't stop it, can it? You can't stop. It's like they only like one thing. I enjoyed Walk the Line, but my problem with it was this idea that it feels like it's a film that tries to mythologize Johnny Cash and has him sort of as this sort of always very, what's the word, like a kind of authentic country star. And with this sort of, and for sure, he definitely had problems, such sort of substance abuse. But often these times of him in the sort of 70s as this kind of sort of lone musician doing the Folsom prison gigs. And it's almost like maintaining this thing as being quite a cool character where you go, but around that same time, Johnny Cash is in Columbo episodes and doing like, so he's much more showbiz than the film makes to make out.
He's doing a Christmas special.
Yeah, it's that kind of, all that stuff, all to me, that makes up more of a career. I find that more interesting. Yeah, I think there's a real commitment in that film to mythologize a lot of these musicians. Like, I love David Bowie, but his whole career feels totally mythologized to being this kind of super uber artist, when it's like, yeah, but, you know, he was on TFI Friday in the 90s. It's not like it was, you know what I mean? There's much like, and I think he did it himself. Like, I think he's really...
He did a film with Muppets. And that's one of his best things.
Yeah, I think there's that kind of, that these people weren't incredibly inaccessible kind of art projects. They were kind of real people. And one of the things I always really like about David Bowie is when you see him interviewed and just how funny he is. And yet it's almost that I think now to a lot of his fans, perhaps sort of newer fans, it's almost like they've remoulded him into something else. And I think that's very true of Johnny Cash.
By newer fans, do you mean people that really embraced the fact that he died?
Yeah, people that were really pleased that he died.
Because I think it was sort of like, I don't know, there was a lot of people came out to be huge David Bowie fans when he died, in a way that, I don't know, does it make you relevant?
Well, I think it's, because I think that was kind of, I think what that narrative that's created by him dying and him, and I think he did it. I think he tried to create more of a mythology about himself again, like the kind he would have had in the early 70s with Ziggy Stardust, where it's like, is he real? Is it not real? Is it, what's the, how much is theatrical, how much performance, and how much is just the real person? And I think he did that on purpose. And he was able to do that because he took like 11 years off or whatever he did, where he just didn't do anything, where he's sort of bringing up his daughter and things. And he sort of led this very quiet life and was able to kind of live quite anonymously in New York, and then decides he's going to release records again, but he's not going to tour. And again, when he comes back, he's kind of granted this sort of new, he sort of regained this sort of animosity. So he kind of almost wants to hold on to it. And anonymity.
When he came back, he gained this seething anger and hatred towards others. And he really used that, yeah, in his last days. Go on, sorry.
Anonymity. So I think when
you mean anonymity? Sorry, listeners. This is what happens when he's left to his own devices. Carry on.
I think that's it. And he sort of, and then that's used. And I think as someone who's kind of aware of this stuff, and I think he did it on purpose, and I think it is, makes for something interesting. He uses that to make himself, oh, I can mythologize myself again and be like I was in the 70s. I think it kind of came about by accident. And I like that. I like that he did it. And I think it's great that he's able to tie all this sort of real-world narrative into the kind of sort of slightly fictionalized idea of himself that he creates when he creates these characters and things. I think that's great. But then I think it's almost that sort of too often that stuff is, when people talk about like Black Star, his last album, it's that kind of thing about, oh, it's so great that all these songs are about sort of mortality and things. And you go, yeah, it is. But it's still what you get, isn't this kind of, it isn't a great thing that he was able to tie his own death into this last album. The really sad thing about it is he's a guy who's going through cancer treatment and it doesn't work and he dies. Of course his songs are going to be about mortality because that's what he's thinking about and that's all on his mind because he might well die. But what we actually get is a really sad outcome. But it's almost like it's been reframed as this kind of celebratory way of what this amazing thing that he's like created this art right up until the end. Whereas actually, I think if you're a fan of his, it's like, no, it's tragic. You know, it's not a really like amazing work of art. It's tragic because he died. Whereas it'd be much better if you could have got more albums. You could have got more work out of it. Do you know what I mean? It's not actually this sort of amazing piece of art. It's a sad thing. And I think that's where you should look at it. You should look at it as a sad thing that he died while making that album. This is a bit of a downer.
No, I think it's interesting. It's really interesting. As an Alice Cooper fan, you know, he's, what, cranking out a covers album, and you think, you're 74. You haven't got time to be doing covers albums. What are you doing a fucking covers album for? Do you know what I mean? There'll be a time when you know, he's either too old or he's not around where he can't be making any albums, and you just think, just create stuff while you're around, please. I mean, you know, I wonder how many people will come out as an Alice Cooper fan when... Probably not as many as David Bowie. He's not as cool, I have to say. I love him, but I do appreciate he's an acquired taste.
But I think there's a lot about him to be discovered by the general public, and certainly things I didn't know about that you've kind of introduced me to that I go, oh, that's really interesting. And he's also like he's a different performer than I think of him as, and he's been, like David Bowie, he's been doing lots of different things over the years.
Yeah, lots of different things that aren't particularly successful, that haven't been particularly successful, embraced. He's really run. But, yeah, like you say, he's like, I think that you do, though, don't you? You'd be, like, I was talking about Stallone the other day, where Stallone basically mythologizes himself. Mm. He only concentrates on the good stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he slags Rocky V off whenever it comes up. He always goes on about Stopping My Mom Will Shoot being his worst film. You know, he's made worse. Rhinestone is better than Stopping My Mom Will Shoot. Stopping My Mom Will Shoot is terrible. He's really good in it. I've said this over and over again. It's a terrible film. He's really good in it. And Rocky V is brilliant all the way up until the ending, where the ending is kind of like, oh, no, not this. It's different from the others, just like Rocky IV is different from the others. Rocky III was so similar, like, you go... He's barely Rocky in Rocky III. It's basically the Sylvester Stallone story. Like, he says stuff that is of a different intelligence to the character Rocky. Do you know what I mean? If you're going to pick apart your own career, there are other places that you can pick them, but you're not going to pick on Rocky III because Rocky III was successful. It's got Mr. T in it, and everyone that loves Rocky III, right? So you're not going to go in and say, yeah, but that one. So you're going to go in and sort of like, you know, not mention Rhinestone and not talk about that. And, you know, Alice Cooper does the same, where he's sort of like, oh, yeah, I wear kind of like leather and have big black hair. It's just like, yeah, but you only started doing that from like 1986. You know, that's because of Motley Crue and Bon Jovi and Aerosmith. Mm-hmm. Before that, you were fucking fucking Maurice Escargot, the French fucking detective from Lace and Whiskey. And you're performing on Wogan. You're performing on Wogan with fucking rubber, you know, fucking rubber chickens. And you know, absolutely, it was like, you know, so, yeah, it's just, people can pick and choose what they want people to remember them for, I guess.
We do a bit of fan mail.
So let's do some fan mail. Come in, Brian. Oh, thank you very much. Right. Hi guys, I loved the chat with Eddie Hearn. It made me think I need to take up some exercise. I don't like not sitting down. What can you recommend I do? Nick, you seem quite fit.
That's very kind of you.
What's your regimen? Thanks, Dan.
What's your regimen?
What's my regime? I'm not at the moment. I'm not drinking or smoking, and I hope that will last forever or for a while.
Well, that's very good for you, just for a start. I mean.
So I've replaced it with cake. So I'm not really going to the gym because my gym is closed, but go to the gym. I if you can afford it, get a personal trainer because it makes you do it. And if not, then just, you know, people's pervert, what's his name? Joe Wicks. The people's PE teacher, Joe Wicks. Yeah. I don't know. Just try and get out and do some exercise. I worked out that a bottle of Jammy Red Roux, if you drink a bottle of Jammy Red Roux, which is basically Ribena with alcohol, you drink a bottle of that, I say I worked out, I looked it up, it's 205 calories per 250 milliliter glass, right? Which means that a bottle is 615 calories, right? And I can smash two of them. So that is 1,230 calories. No, 1,230 calories, right? For two bottles of Jammy Red Roux, right? Which is over half of your daily intake, right? A donut from a vanilla custard donut from Sainsbury's is something like 210 calories. So if you eat three of those, you're still better off than you would be if you just drank two bottles of Jammy Red Roux. So that's my maths there, guys. So I hope that helps, Dan. Just look at the calories. Plus, it doesn't fuck your liver up. It will give me diabetes, but I'm not planning on doing it forever. I'm just easing my way into 2021. Hi, lads! I'm well sad that Glastonbury's been cancelled. Have you got any fun tales from festivals? None. No fun tales.
No, I've got awful tales of going to festivals and things. And it's not something that overly appeals to me, going to festivals. But, I mean, I've been to festivals essentially since I started doing comedy for gigs and things. And I've had some awful experiences performing at festivals.
Maybe what we should do is we should do a Glastonbury special and we should talk about all of the festival stories that we've got next week.
We could do next week and do... There are tons of awful gigs.
And if you're listening live, why don't you write in with all of your festival stories and we'll read some out. And we'll talk about our gigs and any experiences we've had at festivals, and we'll play music and stuff from festivals and stuff. It is fan club, it doesn't have to be about films, we'll give that a go. Alright, dear Nick and Matt, my boss has recently got me into Kevin Smith. So far I've watched Clerks and Mallrats, and I'd like them both a lot. What's your favourite? Do you think his Superman film would have been any good, Greg? I think Clerks and Mallrats are his best.
I remember liking Mallrats. I haven't seen it for years and years. And I remember liking Dogma, but I can't... Again, I haven't seen it in years and years. It might not hold up.
I don't like Dogma, and I find his refusal to grow as a filmmaker infuriating.
The Superman film, I think what's a shame now is that when people were always criticising his Superman film, which was the one that Tim Burton was going to make, is that now it just feels like it would have been good, right? That you just would have had this extra thing. It doesn't matter if they're bad Superman films or bad Batman films.
No, I think that's right. Yeah, they made two Spider-Man films that they've just pretended, you know, oh, well, they didn't work, so we'll just make some more. I just think that they should have just kept making them. I think it's ridiculous that we're still obsessed with Christopher Reeve. Now we've got Henry Cavill, but, like, I think that's weird. Henry Cavill, I think it's weird. I think when you see pictures of Nicolas Cage dressed up as Superman in order to get, you just think, well, why didn't they make that? They should have just made it.
Crazy. And if it was bad, we wouldn't watch it so much. And if it was interesting, we might still be watching it.
Absolutely. We haven't got time for the next two, so we'll do them next week, and we'll play a song, and then we'll bring our guest on.
Yes.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we are back. My name's Nick, this is Nathaniel, and we're joined in the studio now by Ludi Lin. Hello, Ludi Lin, how are you?
I'm good, man. Good afternoon, good morning.
Where are you?
I'm in Vancouver, beautiful Vancouver, Canada.
in Vancouver. What are you doing in Vancouver? Is that where you live?
That's where Mum is, and I'm about to start a project here next week. So,
are you allowed to talk about the project you're working on at the moment?
No, stay tuned. Okay. It's a good one. Everyone will see it.
Okay.
Okay. So going from that project that you can't talk about, you are also in the upcoming Mortal Kombat movie, which is over. It's coming out on April the 16th on HBO Max. So what can you say about the Mortal Kombat film that you've just done? Is it a film? It's a film.
It's a film. Yeah, it's a film. I can say that it'll be bloody great. And I have a lot of fun doing it. I think you guys will have a lot of fun watching it.
How familiar were you with the game or with kind of any previous incarnation of it?
Well, I still remember the first time I was playing the game and I accidentally did one of those fatalities. Probably the first day I opened it up and I was like, what is this? This is something different. From then on, I followed it for a bit. And I was going through high school when the movies came out. It was great. I mean, I skipped the... I know people... I just rewatched it. I was a bit fearful that it might shatter some of my childhood memories if I watch it again. But it's just as fun. And so I'm happy about that. And I skipped class to watch Annihilation, the second one, in the theatres. And I actually had to lie about my age to sneak into that one. I thought it was great at the time. I haven't rewatched it yet. That one's a bit more dicey, I think. It's a bit more dangerous on the childhood destroying meter.
Yeah, that's got some of the early morphing special effects that they use at the end. That's kind of a bit ropey in places. But the first one had Chris Lambert in it, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Didn't the second one?
It may have. It's been a while since I've seen it.
I don't remember the second one. I rewatched it, I didn't remember most of the scenes. I just remember I loved it as a kid. And, it was like watching a new movie.
Does that feel significant to you now, then, being in it? Does it feel like a bit of a moment?
It is a bit of a moment. A lot of my career here has been a bit of a moment. Like, I watched Power Rangers when I was a kid, too. That was a bit of a moment. This is a bit of a moment. And Black Mirror is one of my favorite shows. I got to be a part of that. That was a bit of a moment. So I guess as an actor, getting any job is a bit of a moment. Yeah, it's really a lot of fun.
And what was that? I know I was reading on your biography on IMDb that was saying that one of the things you got into was seeing your mother, was it, in the theatre?
Well, look, my mum, like any mum, she's a warrior. She's got a very hard time believing that I'm a working actor. So from time to time, I bring her to set, to premieres and stuff, to remind her that that it is real, that I'm not just lying about it. But, you know, she believes me in that moment, but quickly forgets afterwards. So I have to keep working and keep proving myself to her, which is it's a good motivation.
Nick and I's background is in stand-up comedy, and the one time my parents have ever seen me do stand-up was in a competition where I was in the kind of big, huge theatre, which would not be where I'd normally do gigs in. But it's nice to think that the time they've seen me, that when I say I'm doing a gig, I like that they imagine it's probably in a big theatre than in a tiny club somewhere. So I find that's a kind of, it's a sort of reassuring thing to go, this is fine, look, I'm doing fine, this isn't bad.
Yeah. So how does it work on Zoom now? Do you guys still do it?
I've done some gigs over Zoom, but it's very difficult. It's not really the same thing.
It's horrible.
So you can just tell her that millions are probably watching right now.
It could be. We don't know. And
yeah.
Sure.
All right, you guys asked away. I'm just gonna do a set of this right now.
Okay, this is a fan club first. talk us through what you're actually doing. We've just had one of our listeners write in and ask for
ask me for advice about how to keep fit during lockdown. And I've just said drink less. But let's just talk us through what you're doing right now.
Well, I'm known to wake up very early to do my workouts. A long time ago when I started working, I realized what the hours are on a movie set. I sort of got rid of the idea of must going to sleep at night and wake up when the sun rises. I just go to sleep whenever I can, basically, depending on what the call time is in the morning. Mm. And so this morning, it's almost your tea time over there, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yeah, 7 o'clock. It's quarter past three at the moment.
Right. So we've got 45 minutes before you have to go. So I just, I set my brain clock to whenever I need to wake up. And then I usually train first thing in the morning because that's when I can just be by myself and, you know, catch up on podcasts and the latest dad jokes and stuff while I train. So it's quite enjoyable. And in the pandemic, have you guys ever seen the movie Old Boy, the Korean movie?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Right. I just pretend I'm that guy. So I've set up a little home gym with a squat rack, and usually I do a lot of calisthenics. And so, like that guy in the morning, I'm usually stuck in here for, you know, 3-4 hours. I have some injuries from Mortal Kombat, not fatally, but I have some injuries. I'm recovering from that in preparation for my next thing. I'm just doing some deadlifts for my back right now.
Oh wow!
Do you enjoy deadlifts?
I kind of do. You know, in a it's a love-hate relationship. You know, I like it when I can kick its ass. And I don't like it when it kicks mine.
Sure.
So let's see how this one goes. Just give me like 20 seconds. I promise.
I really love deadlifts.
And I'll do my best. Yeah, it's a great exercise.
Yeah, I find it quite fun.
And if you're me, what is a deadlift? Is it just lifting a weight?
I'll let Lady Lynn concentrate. And a deadlift is basically you're using your legs. You basically have kind of like this weight rack that is like a circle around you, and then you put weights on either side of you, and then you do what he's doing, which is basically you grab it and then you grab it either side of you and you keep it straight back, and then you use your legs to sort of like stand up straight and then you kind of like bring them down again. I think it kind of like works your legs and your bum, really.
Yeah. It's important to work your bum, apparently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, my bum is in mint condition, so that's a callback. So, so I really love deadlifts. How heavy are you lifting?
Not too heavy at the moment. Maybe like, I don't know, 200-300. I work my way up and then back down just to make sure I'm in good form.
And do you try and keep inside a peak? I suppose it depends on what kind of movie you're filming, but I guess if you're filming an action movie, do you have to kind of feel you're in kind of peak fitness while you're filming? Or is it something you can kind of work on up to the point you start filming and then you're kind of in the midst of filming days and things?
Yeah, it depends on the schedule. I usually do a lot of preparation ahead of time and then just make sure that you're flexible enough and you're, I think mostly it's mental. And I always find time to keep fit during filming as well, because it's kind of like a meditation for me. Mm-hmm. That's why I do it really early when I'm alone. Like sometimes on Mortal Kombat, I would be, say the call time's at 4 o'clock and I would get up at 1. Heading to the 24-hour gym. And then, you know, we film in Australia, so people like their drink there, just like you guys. So they would be watching outside the bars, watching me walk by with my gym gear, and they'll still be sloshing away at their beers and their drink, finishing up. And they'll look at me like they're hallucinating. At 1 a.m, yeah.
Wow.
But that's so exciting, isn't it? I mean,
it's pretty exciting, yeah. Gets me going.
I always, yeah, I mean, when I, because I do acting in that, and I always find that getting up when it's still dark and everyone else is still asleep, and then getting home when it's dark and everyone's going to bed, I always love, like, I really love the long days and the long hours. And also going to the gym is really therapeutic, mentally. So exciting. Sorry, I've been locked in my flat for a year and a half, or however long it's been. So no, it's not even been that long yet, has it? 10 months. Yeah, I'm just fantasizing about getting up and leaving my flat.
Yeah, we aim low during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Our life goals are set back a little bit. Aim low. Just getting up is good enough. Getting out is amazing.
Your biggest roles have been in things like the upcoming Mortal Kombat and Power Rangers, and again the episode of Black Mirror, but they're all kind of action parts. Is that where you see your career going? Or are you very open to everything?
Fairly open. I think a lot of people see those things because they're big studio films. And I've done some of those in China as well, but I've explored smaller indies as well. There's one called Summer Night that was filmed in Sichuan province last year in China. And that won one of the best Futures Film Award in Tokyo Film Festival last year before the pandemic. And that was a smaller story about a kid getting his bike stolen in the 90s in China and, you know, doing dialects and all that. It was a very small operation. But yeah, I enjoy that stuff as well. It's very different, you know? It's like comparing
What came first for you? Was it the kind of... Because I know you've got a background in martial arts. And again, you're saying your mum was in the theatre and things. So have you always been kind of wanting to be an actor? Or was the martial arts more of a hobby that you were able to kind of bring into your acting career?
Look, yeah, I didn't come into martial arts that early. So it's not too late to start for anybody. It's interesting because I was talking to... I had a conversation with Robin Hsu. And he actually started martial arts fairly late as well when he was 19. And I think he was a model before, something before that. So it was, you know, when I was a kid, I moved around a lot and I played a lot of video games because that was a consistent friend, a friend that was always there. And I just figured, why play sports when you can play it on TV, and why do martial arts when you can play, you know, Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter and all that. And then once I got into it, I really got into it. But acting has always been something that's really fun for me ever since I was a kid. I really don't think people decide to start acting. I think it's like most people when they decide to stop acting, because every kid acts and pretends and plays. But at some point, someone goes, you know, you must make money, bottom line, or the accountant's going to be pissed off. So... yeah, I just never stopped, I guess.
It's interesting.
Yeah, a lot of people told me I couldn't do it, so that made me want to do it even more.
You couldn't? People told you you weren't allowed to act?
Yeah, like, I mean, I didn't have the most supportive drama teachers. Like, you know, in school, there's all these theatre kids that are always that way, right? Very theatre kiddish. I remember in drama class, I wanted to play Romeo because I had a crush on Juliet, and the drama teacher told me you can't be Romeo, and she didn't really tell me why, but I kind of understood. And then in the end, I did get to date Juliet, and yeah, I just wanted to be able to prove her wrong.
Was that the same? Because I read that your mum was initially kind of wasn't encouraging about you being an actor. Is that right? Or is that now that you're kind of in big successful films, does it seem like, oh yeah, I mean, you've made it? Do you feel that you've got to keep proving yourself in that
regard? Always. It's like acting's a funny job because you have to keep proving yourself. It's like, you know, if you're a dentist, after you do one operation, a root canal or something, before you do the next one, they don't make you take a test and interview you again. But with acting, it's like that. And with my mom, it's especially like that because, like I said, if I bring her to a set or a premiere, she'll be happy. So she's so happy. She's ecstatic. And she even, I mean, I don't see her cry that much, but she really cried when I brought her to the Power Rangers premiere. But then she always wanted me to be either a doctor or a lawyer. And so, you know, whenever I get sick, she'll be like, you know, if you weren't an actor, if you became a doctor, you could just prescribe yourself medicine right now and cure yourself. And so, yeah, that's the way it goes. You always have to prove yourself. I like it. You know, I'm used to it.
You're a driven person. I'm impressed that you're still kind of doing this kind of work out now. You're speaking to us and it feels like you do seem almost uniquely qualified to do things like action movies where you do have this background in martial arts. You've also got this thing where you're called multilingual, which now means that you can be in things like The Ghost Bride on Netflix and things. Do you feel like the world of not just action cinema, but I guess cinema in general is going to be more international in the future? Do you think something like The Ghost Bride is sort of Taiwanese, Malaysian, but it's on Netflix, so it's immediately international. Everyone can watch it wherever they are.
Yeah, I think it's quite inevitable for this to happen, right? I'm really looking forward to it. And when I set out my career and not only focus on North America and the West, and when I went back to China to do films there, I really had that in mind. Is like, you know, either we do this and start communicating and sharing culture, or we probably end up in some really worse situation and share missiles and you know, bullets and stuff. So I think it's a way to bridge that gap. Mm-hmm. So and I'm so happy that Netflix has gotten a lot of the world audience to read subtitles. Because I don't know why in Chinese films, every single film has subtitles, like even subtitles in Mandarin and in English, every single film. So people are just used to watching subtitles there, and that's why they love Western films, because they can understand it. But there's so much European cinema, and I think Netflix has really shoved that down people's throats.
I think it's great.
Yeah, it's really good.
If I'm tired, I'll sort of like steer clear of subtitles because I just don't feel like reading that late at night. But I was watching The Ghost Bride, at first you have like, maybe there's a little bit of resistance to read subtitles just coming from someone that lives in England. But it's just really easy to follow. And it's a really enjoyable TV show. I mean, you're now deadlifting again. I feel like if I say the wrong thing, you're going to...
Slide. No, you're good, man.
I felt like there was a lot. I was like half critiquing your TV show and then half like going, and
half
okay,
critiquing my form.
A few weeks ago, we had Jason Isaacs and Simon West on the show, and Simon West in particular is now kind of working more in China as someone who would work in, like, you know, Hollywood, a British director working in Hollywood, who's now kind of found that he's found this almost like second career working in China and making action.
Yeah.
And someone, I guess, now that so many movies in Hollywood, I guess, are more franchise superhero movies or whatever, but in a way, the kind of action movies that he was making in the kind of late 90s have kind of gone away, but they do make them in China. And he and Jason Isaacs were making films in China and making like a bilingual action movie, which has apparently been this huge hit. I mean, it just feels like, does it feel to you that especially action movies feel like they are becoming more international?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, a part of acting is the action, right? Like they always say that most of your communication comes from body language. And for me, that works on so many levels, because when I mean, one of my Muay Thai coaches once told me that, you know, in the ring, you don't talk, you communicate by your fists. And that's why when you're training in Thailand, it's not like two guys trying to just cripple each other and permanently, you know, put each other in the wheelchair, but it's more of a sharing, right? So you're talking with your fists, and it's very honest. You can never lie, because when someone punches you in the face, it hurts, and it hurts. There's no there's no talking around that. So so I think action is, it's very easy to understand, and it's a lot of fun for people. And I think it'll make I think history guides us, and film history as well. So I think, you know, whatever action movies, that fad that went away, I think it'll come back in some way to guide us in the future. Mm-hmm. Maybe in Mortal Kombat, who knows?
Well, I was watching earlier this week, funny enough, I was watching A Quiet Place, and I'd never seen it. And I was so impressed with it. Essentially, you're watching it's a silent movie. It's a film about an alien invasion. You're essentially watching a silent movie that has so little dialogue in, just the nature of it. And what you're also creating is this thing where you realise that no one's speaking, everything's, all the storytelling's visual. And actually what you get at the end of it is something that's much more cinematic, because what you're not watching is people, like, reading dialogue to each other, essentially.
So
like, it's almost like that is in itself, like, this kind of brilliant international film. And you're going almost back to silent cinema. There's something, like, very kind of, it's much more cinematic in a way.
Yeah, I mean, people don't like exposition, like, they don't like talking just for the sake of talking, right? They'd rather see what's what is playing out on screen. And also, I think that, like, the difference between, because I started in theatre, I think the difference between theatre and cinema is that when you watch a movie, you should be able to turn out the sound and understand what's going on. And in theatre, you should be able to go in blind and understand what's going on. So that's two types of fun things to play with in performing art.
That's interesting. When it comes to sort of training for martial arts and going to the gym, you know, you can kind of train all the time, can't you? But in terms of, like, acting, when you're in between jobs, it's kind of one of those things that you're like, when you're not acting, you're waiting to act. Do you know what I mean?
When you're, when you're acting, you're waiting to act as well.
So explain that.
I mean, when you're acting, most of the time, it's the prep work that goes into it, right? And then when you're on set, you're just waiting for the setup, you know, for the lights and the cameraman and everyone to be ready. You're constantly waiting. So it's kind of a waiting game. That's why I think a lot of people get into meditation, because that's just waiting in stillness. And I think when you're off set, I think you're constantly in preparation as well. Because I think, like, anything we do, interviews, reading, anything works into acting as long as you learn something about yourself. Mm-hmm. And for me, when I actually started getting paid to act and started learning what it takes to be in a major role in a movie, that really changed my stance on what acting is. Because a lot of people will say it's a great career, you get to be whoever you want, playing different people. But for me, it's, at the end of the day, it's like, the more you know yourself and the more you know how you would act in certain situations, the better actor you become. Because it's kind of like, it goes full circle, because you go through all this journey. In the end, you just come back to yourself and you're that single person. And the more you know that person, the more real and the better you'll be at telling a story.
Where do you see yourself? Are you someone that has kind of 5-year plans and things, or can you not in this industry? Can you only just take each job at a time, or do you kind of have, or where would you see yourself if you could 5 years from now?
Yeah, I do see myself, and that's the direction for me. And like you said, I want to build this bridge and do and be like a very international actor, to be able to tell stories wherever I am, and tell it to whoever I want. Mm-hmm. And then I set that as a direction, not as a certain goal, because, you know, sometimes you set a goal and then, say, a pandemic strikes and then you have to change your plans, right? So, it's just an upward trajectory and finding more interesting roles and interesting things, and also writing as well, developing projects and stories to tell, and also, you know, different things about myself, different aspects of it.
This is Fan Club, so we were asking you to come up with some of your favourite things and things that you're a fan of. And,
okay.
And we were looking at some of your favourite films that you told us about. And interestingly, you've put your all-time favourite film is Her. Is that the Spike Jonze film?
Yeah. Yeah, I love Spike Jonze.
Tell us about Her, because, again, that's one of his films that I think is kind of interesting for you, because that's a film that now, watching it, feels very much like an extended episode of Black Mirror or something. It's got a very similar storyline than an episode of that might be.
Yeah, that's right, totally. What do I love about it? I love about it in that it's really relatable. It's like, you know, just a bit far into the future, but it could really happen now. It is kind of like Black Mirror. I love the fact that you can't really place where he is, because part of it was shot in Shanghai and part of it was very like Silicon Valley, San Francisco-ish kind of vibe, right? It's super relatable, because I think I saw it while I was still in China working on something, and the way that people embrace technology in China is really crazy. Because nobody carries a wallet anymore since, you know, 5 years ago, since like online digital payment system came on. And you'll go to these like farmers markets where 80, 90 year old. And while I'm trying, I love to cook by myself. I love to cook because like I'm vegan. So I like to shop for things that, that I know how to make a great dish of. And I know where the ingredients are coming from. So these 80, 90 year old, Chinese farmers that bring their stuff that they've actually grown themselves to market, they'll know how to use, they don't take cash anymore. You know, they'll have a little QR code on their stand of like rockets or apples or something like that, and they'll just take it like that. So it's just far enough off in the future. And I love that, you know, it boggles my mind that existentialist, what love means and all that stuff. I just love it. It's a good, good romantic movie, and it's never boring for a second. And the performances are really great. I love that song, the Moon Song. It's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. And more recently, you've put Promising Young Woman, which is a movie which hasn't even opened here yet. I think another thing that's been affected by the pandemic. When have you seen that?
We get screeners to vote for the awards, because that season's coming up. So I saw that just recently, actually. And it's so good. It's really funny and a lot of fun. It's very relevant. It's really funny. It's a lot of fun. Makes men hate themselves to a small degree.
And I don't think like, I need a film for that. I think I can
Right. Yeah, we do a good enough job by ourselves. But it's fun. It's like you can't really peg the genre it's in. Sometimes it's like a romantic comedy, sometimes it's a thriller, sometimes it's it's a lot of different things. It's a mixed bag. And that's what I love about it.
So was that your choice as being a more recent film that you've liked, but you think Her might be your favorite all time?
Yeah, I think Her might be one of my favorites. I love all the Nolan films. I didn't even realize how much I liked him until someone got me to list all my favorite films, and all of his films are on there. So I love him. Some of the Chinese films, I love like Stephen Chow films. I was addicted to them when I was a kid. Stephen Chow was a prolific actor and a great director, producer as well from China. So I watched this comedy as I was growing up. And when I had to move from Hong Kong to Australia and then to Canada and the States, I mean, I was sad because I was leaving my family, but I think I was just a little bit more sad because I couldn't watch Stephen Chow films anymore, or what it felt like. So yeah, love that stuff.
But he's a guy that's taken martial arts and he's shifted it into, you know, physical comedy.
Yeah.
in a way that's kind of, I mean, when you look back at Buster Keaton from like 100 years ago now, 100 years ago, and then you look back at kind of like Silent. I saw a thing this week from The General, which was the Buster Keaton film about the train, and there were all of these young people that were commenting about the fact that the train is only going 1 mile an hour. Buster Keaton's doing all of these stunts on this train, and all of like the millennials are going, "Yeah, but it's only going 1 mile an hour. What's that?" It's never occurred to me that the train is only going 1 mile an hour. It's always only been impressive. And it's like 100 years time, people will be criticising Tom Cruise holding onto the side of the plane while it's taking. He's using both his hands.
I think you'd be in a bit of trouble.
In 100 years time. Yeah, but he's kind of like, if you look at Stephen Chow, he's kind of like, he's kind of like a modern day silent movie star, like what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I think if you turn the sound off, all you'll hear is your own laughter when you're watching a Stephen Chow movie. It's still so funny. It's all on Netflix now, so yeah, I can relive that part of my childhood as well.
And just before you came on, we were playing The Most Beautiful Thing, which is a single by Bruno Major. And he wasn't even an artist I was familiar with, but he's from Northampton in England. And the song itself seems to be like referencing, like almost like, is it like a relationship between someone in London and someone in the States somewhere, or New York, is it?
Yeah, maybe. But for me, it's like it tells a good story. You know, I can really picture it and imagine it. And there's even dialogue in the song. He tells the waiter and tries to make a funny excuse for what he's doing. Yeah.
He's a new name for me. Where have you come across Bruno Major?
I think Spotify.
Okay.
Yeah. I think you just turn on and sometimes, like, I'm not even listening. And then my ear perks up, like something just hits. I'm like, oh, I love this tune. I know immediately, like I think a lot of people do, I know immediately within the first 2 seconds of the song whether I'm going to like it or not. It's I start learning a lot of things during the pandemic. Like I'm working on some singing, and I won't blow out your headphones with it now, but it's just so intriguing. Like I didn't even know what's it called? Suffrage. What you learn as a kid, do re mi fa so.
Oh yeah,
those are nothing. Those aren't even spaced evenly apart, and there's a chromatic scale that is just half notes apart. I don't know if you guys are into music, but yeah. I didn't know this, right? And then there's this test on the internet where it gives you a ear training, and the notes are only like three hertz apart, and you need to tell the difference whether or not it's higher or lower, whether it's a sharp or a flat. And then knowing that, it's like, it really is like a superpower that no one ever taught you. And to know perfect pitch, you should get trained before you were six. Otherwise you can't have it for the rest of your life. And I hate that. I don't know. I don't remember if I got that training or not, if I have perfect pitch or not. So it's like, it really hits you somewhere deep inside, knowing that it's something so innate, I think, music.
This is one of the things I like about doing this, because you kind of, I always think that it's always interesting talking to people about their favourite things, because you get a real insight into who you are. And it already feels like the things that have come up consistently just over the past half hour talking to you is that you've got this kind of drive and ambition of where you want to be. And I like the idea that even in the pandemic, you've kind of got this thing about self-improving. You're talking, while you're talking to us, you're making us feel bad because you're training. And to us, this is an hour off. We don't have to do anything else but sit on our chairs. And you've learning, while in lockdown, you're kind of learning singing, which is something you haven't done before. So what was lockdown to you? Was it an opportunity to learn something else or do more stuff? Is that how you approach things in general? Is that your mindset to go, right, well, I'm stuck indoors, so what can I do?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of meaning in everything. So in lockdown, it's like, that's why people meditate, I think. A lot of people take, like, I read about this this kind of a cycle that a lot of philosophers and existentialists, they go through. Like, first they ask the meaning of life, and then they happen to stumble upon, like, some sort of plant, mushroom or something in the wild, and they go on this trip, and then they try to sustain that trip. It doesn't work, so they start meditating and then move to Asia to know what it's really all about and become a monk. And then they have to quit being a monk to spread the message, and they come back and they philosophize, you know? So for me in lockdown, it was kind of like that. It's just been one long day for a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. For me as well, it hasn't ended yet. Like you know, I haven't gone to sleep during the lockdown yet. So I'm just keeping myself busy in the meantime and see what meaning I can gain from the situation. But, you know, I was fortunate enough because we shot Mortal Kombat before the lockdown, and then we had to work during the lockdown as well, during the quarantine. So I had to fly down to Australia, of course, to finish shooting. And that was quite an experience, because most of the stuff we did on set was mostly physical. Like, sometimes we do something and then it's amazing, it's absolutely beautiful, but then we get a little bit depressed afterwards, because we think that, you know, when people see this, they just think it's computer graphics, but it's really not. Like, we travel to crazy places, like the outback of Australia, and these, you would never guess that this is Earth. It looks like another planet, another dimension, another realm, if you will, in Mortal Kombat. But then we worked again during the lockdown, where everything is kind of like old boy. Everything is just in a big studio on green screens and blue screens and stuff to fix those shots.
Does that feel like, is that something that's frustrating, or how can you get around that? How do you film something that you know is kind of hard to achieve, and you know it's not CGI, and you know that you're doing it? In the movie, how are you kind of overcoming that? Is there just more of a sense of physicality? How do you kind of get across that we are doing this? This isn't CGI or something.
Oh, I think people can tell. I just hold that hope that it, even if it is, it has an effect on the audience. I don't really care. Whatever gets the job done, right? I know I enjoyed it. And I don't think it's finished until someone sees it. So how they receive it is part of the fun. Mm-hmm. But I think in some ways that people can tell, because if you watch those action movies from the 90s and compare them to now, they have a different feel to them, like a different analog, gritty feel, even if the explosions or the action is a bit cheesy. But you know, it's like, it feels different. Yeah. Like the camera moves in a way where it obeys the laws of physics, right? And also a fun part of it is, you mentioned Buster Keaton before, where he sets up his scenes and stuff. It's like a magic trick. Mm-hmm. It's like part of the fun is how to set it up. You know, if I place this background here, it looks like a real painting or whatever. For them, it's like they're magicians.
Yeah.
And it's not just one magic answer, CG to everything. So
it's like Nick was saying before about Tom Cruise, that he has this thing where he's, for the most part, trying to make it appear to be as real as possible, and now that becomes the selling point. It's almost something that would have been commonplace 20 years ago is now the selling point of the movie. Like, oh, it's Tom Cruise doing this stunt.
If you look at the first Mission Impossible, the big set piece was him hanging on the top of a train, which was largely CGI. Mm. And then when he did the second one, it was him hanging off the side of a mountain without a safety net. And then after that, it was like, oh, this is what the franchise is. It's Tom Cruise doing an impossible stunt. It's kind of interesting the way that films have changed, because I've recently watched the first six Star Wars films again.
Oh yeah.
When you look at the original three, it's kind of like, it's almost sort of surprising when you see than all of the action sequences in maybe like The Return of the Jedi. When you see the action sequences, that it's almost surprising how little information you actually get, you know, in terms of what you're looking at. You see a guy jump from, you know, one vehicle to another vehicle, That's that shot. And then you see a guy, you know, you see Luke Skywalker kick at someone's face and, like, miss by quite a considerable amount. And then the person reacting, that's that shot. And then when you watch the prequels, there are these huge kind of, like, three-minute shots where the camera is flying through the air, nothing's real, it's all CGI. And it's kind of like, in some ways, it's much more impressive, you know. But in other ways, your brain knows that it's not real, so you're not connecting to it.
Yeah, I agree. I think your brain does a good job in, like, imagination and filling the blanks. Nobody ever goes, that book wasn't great because the CG sucked, you know. You're not you're just reading words on a screen and you still get the same effect. So whether you put millions of dollars into special effects to create the sense of, like, excitement or fear in somebody, or you just do it, even on a cell phone or whatever, but that emotion is the same, and that's what people feel. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't feel budget. An audience doesn't go, oh, that was so good. That shot was so freaking expensive. That was so nice. No, right. They go, wow, that was a great fall, or that must have hurt, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or it's a reaction, especially to maybe films that were made 20 years ago. It's a reaction going, how did they do that? You know, your brain is trying to figure stuff out. Whereas if it's all CGI, then your brain knows how they did it, you know. You're kind of like going, did you see the Cats movie?
I did see the Cats movie, yeah. It wasn't that bad.
I thought what was unusual about that was that they had real dancers that were really dancing.
Yeah.
And then they CGI'd their bodies to look like cats. And it was just kind of like, you go, they're really dancing, but they've taken CGI and they've put it over these, like, amazing, like, you know, physical performances, so that your brain is kind of like going, well, it's CGI, isn't it? Well, in actual fact, it was real. They were really dancing. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like it undid itself.
Yeah, that's right. It got played by its own game.
But you don't want to say anything bad about Cats. That's fine.
No, I actually found it fascinating. I mean, during the pandemic, I've had some really vivid dreams. And I think after watching Cats, that really, like, I've had a few dreams about, like, cats, like me being a cat and running around. So I don't know if people out there are experiencing this, but, dreams during this lockdown and pandemic has been just mind-blowing for me.
Yeah, I've had some very vivid dreams.
Yeah, I think so. I think I've had some pretty
yeah, really.
Oh, Dre. I think there is that thing where you're kind of, I mean, in a way here, it almost feels like, you know, you're essentially kind of imprisoned in your own house. So you are having this kind of strange life. So whatever it's doing to your subconscious, I don't know. But I guess any kind of influence is must be affecting what people are dreaming about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a trip. Every night I go to sleep excited because I'm like, I can't wait to see what happens now. But I usually wake up exhausted. Because it's always about, like, some type of thing, like, you got to save the world from vampires that I had this the other day that some vampires had was sucking art. So they don't suck blood, but they suck art. And then we had to rescue this piece hidden in the basement. And then but some vampire in the attic knew that we were there. So then he was trying to explain to me why they do what they do. They were like, we suck art from artists because we want to break them out of the cycle of using art as just money and capitalism and all this stuff. And I woke up going, where did that come from? It's
even your dreams are more exciting than
wild.
I think that's
it's wild.
My dreams are almost like kitchen sink dramas. Like they're very mundane a lot of the time. I wish I was having your dreams.
Your life must be too exciting.
Was there a reason why you took up singing? Was that sort of, was that maybe for work, or was that entirely for pleasure, or both?
Work is always a pleasure for me. I love work. The first year in theatre school, we did musical theatre. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, we've been watching some theatres or musicals lately. And it's just a fun thing to do. It's like, it really is like mind hacking. Music does something to you that's really inexplicable. And yeah, and your voice is like an instrument that you've always got. So, and I'm like, in China, a lot of people do, like, people love karaoke, right? So I'm not a karaoke king, but I want to be after this pandemic is over. I want to just surprise everyone with the next time I hang out with my friends at a karaoke. I just want to blow them away.
And is that's the reason to do it? That's the reason to learn? So you want to impress, or it's kind of, so is it sort of for you or for your friends, or is it for your career? Is the idea that you go, oh, I'll do this and then I'll try and be in a musical? I'll try and do like...
No, I mean, it's all of the above. And mm-hmm. for me, I think one reason to do the biggest reason for me to do anything is because I suck at it. Yeah. And I think, you know, to really enjoy life, and for me to enjoy acting, I have to love the way I suck. And I always tell that to people. They ask me, what's the one secret? I just go, you love the way you suck. And then if you love the way you suck, anything that goes beyond that, you'll really love, you know. So when I'm bad at something, I get really excited about it, because I know that I'll suck for a while, but I'll get better and better and better. And then I'll find something else to suck at, and I'll do that, you know.
I think that's a really great attitude. I really like that idea, because you're kind of, if I thought, hey, wouldn't it be good if I went to a karaoke, but I was actually a really great singer? But that's all it would be. For me, it's just a fantasy. I just have that thing of going, hey, that'd be fun, wouldn't it, if I turned up and I was really good? It's like me saying, what if I just turned up somewhere and I was a great dancer? But I don't do it. Whereas it's something that you go, yeah, do you know what? I'll just learn. I mean, I kind of think that's a completely different attitude. I think that's like, you must be kind of very driven. There must be something in here which is, right, I'm going to improve.
I'm really not. I just really love the way I'm bad at something. And yeah. I find it really fun.
Yeah. And I think that you can get a lot of criticism from other people that take whatever they do very seriously. I mean, that's my attitude to most things. To starting out at doing stand-up comedy, I was obviously terrible when I started. I did get a bit better. And going to the gym, you kind of like, when you start from scratch at the gym, if you haven't sort of like trained your whole life, then you're very bad at that, but you can sort of like see an improvement. I think that's great. Unfortunately, I'm a naturally gifted musician, so I've never quite understood what it's like not to be able to sing. But are you coming in singing from a point of view where you literally couldn't sing and you are teaching yourself how to sing, or could you hold a tune and you're just trying to get better?
I think I wasn't terrible, because I did go through some musical theatre school, but just the little things that you start figuring out, and the way that you get in tune with your voice, it actually helps. In film, we do some ADR, so we like dub ourselves for lines that weren't clear in the movie, and you know, for action scenes, you have to do a lot of grunting. It's go, kung fu grunting, right? And I would lose my voice for days afterwards, because, like, as you can imagine, there's a lot of fighting in Mortal Kombat, and bloody hell, like, there's just so much grunting. That's the hardest part. Mm. And so actually singing lessons teaches you how to not do that, not lose your voice. And it teaches you, I've been doing this thing since I was a kid. Like, now I know what it is. It's this thing. It goes, now I know there's a name for it. It's called the glottal fry, right? And actually, it's actually good for your voice. So you start learning those things. I was always thinking, am I the only person that can do this? But I'm not. You just go on YouTube. It's actually a real exercise. So things like that, you put a name to, I just find it really fascinating.
We've got to wrap up. We've talked to you for an hour. That's gone by really quickly. We've got to play a game with you now, Ludi. So I'm going to hand you over. I mean, Nathaniel's done a lot of talking already. I apologise for that. But I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel now, and he's going to play the game with you.
Okay, Ludi, this game is called Better or Worse, and it's entirely musicians. And you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my opinion to score points. So beginning with Freddie Mercury. Yeah, that's right, it's silly. But is Kurt Cobain better or worse than Freddie Mercury, according to me? What would I say?
Better.
He is better. Is Elton John better or worse than Kurt Cobain?
Better.
Worse.
Worse for me. Madonna, better or worse than Elton John?
Worse.
Better. Better or worse than Madonna?
What is it? Who was it?
Meatloaf. Better or worse than Madonna?
Meatloaf. Worse.
Yes, worse. Martha Stewart, better or worse than Meatloaf?
Worse.
Martha Stewart.
Rod Stewart.
Let's go with Martha Stewart. worse.
He's better. Miley Cyrus, better or worse than Rod Stewart?
Worse.
Worse. David Bowie, better or worse than Miley Cyrus?
Better.
Better. Phil Collins, better or worse than David Bowie?
Worse. Well, worse.
Worse. Frank Sinatra, better or worse than Phil Collins?
Better. Better.
Better. Barbara Streisand, better or worse than Frank Sinatra?
Better.
Worse.
Worse.
Okay.
Seven.
You got seven.
I really got to know you, and then I think we tapped into the same wavelength.
We're on the same wavelength now, Ludi.
Yeah, I feel you, brother.
Well, at least we're seven, which means that you're not as good as Jim Brister, Thomas Coombs, Jason Manford, Joseph Cardani with 10, David Patil, Ken Cheng, Harry Hill, Luke Morley with 9, Matthew Crosby, Susie Dent, Charles Eston, Eddie Hearn, David Hepworth, Jason Isaacson, Simon West, Magical Burns, Matt Morton, Matt Oakheim, Miranda Raisin, Griffiths Jones, Chris Stark, Stephen Whitham with 8. But you aren't as good as Richard Herring, James King, Henry Normal, Janet Varney, and Johnny Vegas with 7, and you're better than Gary Delaney, Frank Harper with 6, and Dave McLean with 5. So, yeah, you scored all. No, you.
Right in the middle.
Slightly worse than average,
50th percentile.
Slightly worse than average. I thought this might be...
Don't tell my mum, that's not an A. I'll disappoint.
Yeah, but, you know, you've got room for improvement now. You can spend the rest of lockdown trying to get even better at this.
Right. We've got to chat after hours. Next
time. Exactly, we're going to have to do some more research on this. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for talking to us, yeah. You've got Mortal Kombat coming out on April the 16th on HBO Max and in theatres. Thanks very much. Enjoy the rest of your workout and lockdown.
All right.
Good luck with everything. Thank you.
I appreciate you guys.
Yes. Oh, don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere. That's where we're going.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to this week's fan club. I've been Nick Helm. That's been Nathaniel Metcalf. We've been talking to Ludi Lynn. And everybody, stay safe, wear a mask, and wash your hands. Right. Thank you. Goodbye.